west of Scotland, some sunshine elsewhere, and again across England and Wales. That's where we've got the highest temperatures. And it's around London this time on Wednesday that we could again hit 31, maybe even 32 Celsius, sorry.
Thanks a lot, Darren. Now on Radio 4, Deborah Weston reads our Book of the Week, Permanent Present Tense, which tells the poignant story of Henry Molaison and his contribution to the science of memory. It's a case still found in most psychology textbooks, but who was he? Today's episode recalls the brain operation that altered Henry's life and contains a powerful description of the surgery that he underwent. But first, Henry himself recorded in 1992 talking to the book's author, the neuroscientist Suzanne Corkin.
You're all set?
Yeah.
How are you feeling today?
Well, I feel okay.
Do you?
Yeah.
That's good. You look great.
Well, thank you.
I understand that you have a little bit of trouble remembering things.
Yes, I do. Well, a lot of trouble remembering things.
How long have you had trouble remembering things?
That I don't know myself. I can't tell you because I don't remember.
Well, do you think it's days or weeks, months, years?
Well, see, I can't put it exactly on a day, week, or month, or year basis.
But do you think it's been more than a year that you've had this problem?
I think about that, about a year or more. Because I believe I had this is just a thought that I'm having myself, that, I possibly have had an operation or something.
This conversation took place in May 1992. Nearly 40 years after Henry's capacity to form long-term memories disappeared as a result of a risky surgical intervention. Henry was a young man of 27 when he had the operation. Now 66, he relied on a walker to prevent falls, but to him, only a short time had passed. He could no longer remember the faces of people he met, places he visited, or moments he lived through. His experiences slipped out of his consciousness seconds after they happened. My conversations with Henry vanished from his mind immediately. At the time of our interview, I had been working with Henry for 30 years. I first met him in 1962 when I was a graduate student. I grew up in Connecticut, a few miles from where Henry lived. When I was 7, I became close friends with a girl who lived across the street, whose father was a neurosurgeon. Years later, while reading articles on memory in medical journals, I came across a report by a doctor who had performed a brain operation to cure a young man's intractable epilepsy. The operation caused the patient to lose his capacity to establish new memories. The doctor who co-authored the article was my friend's father, William Beecher Scoville. The patient was Henry. This childhood connection to Henry's neurosurgeon made the reading more compelling. Later, when I joined Brenda Milner's laboratory at the Montreal Neurological Institute, Henry's case fell into my lap. Brenda had been the first psychologist to test Henry after his operation, and her 1957 paper with Scoville, describing Henry's operation and its awful consequences, revolutionized the science of memory. Henry was famous, but did not know it. Scientific papers were written about him, and his case is one of the most frequently cited in the neuroscience literature. During his life, the people who knew Henry kept his identity private, always referring to him by his initials, H.M., His name was revealed to the world only after his death in 2008. Over the course of decades during which I worked with Henry, it became my mission to make sure he is not remembered just by brief anonymous descriptions in textbooks. Henry Molaison was much more than a collection of test scores and brain images. There was a man behind the initials and a life behind the data. Henry often told me that he hoped that research into his condition would help others live better lives. He would have been proud to know how much his tragedy has benefited science and medicine. Henry was born in 1926 in Manchester, Connecticut. His childhood was indistinguishable from those of many middle-class boys in the 1930s, except that at age 10, he began to have epileptic seizures. At first, Henry's were petite mal seizures, also called absent seizures, in which he just tuned out for a moment. If he was carrying on a conversation, he would stop talking and appear to be daydreaming. These attacks occurred daily, and they never lasted more than 90 seconds, so they did not prevent him from leading a normal life. But a drastic change occurred on his 15th birthday. Henry was riding in the family car when he had a seizure unlike any he had experienced before. His muscles contracted, he lost consciousness, and his body shook with convulsions. His parents drove him directly to the hospital. This was Henry's first grand mal seizure, also called a tonic-clonic seizure. He would lose consciousness, bite his tongue, and occasionally urinate, hit his head, and foam at the mouth. These more violent seizures posed a serious problem for Henry and his family. At school, Henry's epilepsy kept him from fitting in, and he dropped out for several years when he could no longer bear the teasing of other boys. In 1943, at 17, Henry was tall and quiet, with thick glasses, and he kept to himself. After graduating, he worked on an assembly line at the Underwood Typewriter Company in Hartford. Henry rode to and from work with a neighbor every day. He was unable to drive himself, as he still experienced many petite mal seizures every day and intermittent grand mal seizures. The seizures made it hard for Henry to do his job, and he often missed days. He took large doses of anti-epilepsy drugs, but they could not quell the attacks. By this time, Henry was 24 and had come under Scoville's care. In December 1952, when Henry was 26, Scoville noted that Henry had had, at most, one seizure within the past month. He also wrote that Henry was on massive medication. In 1953, knowing that Henry's seizures had been progressing for a decade, Scoville suggested an experimental operation that he hoped would control the attacks and improve Henry's quality of life. The operation would entail removing several inches of brain tissue from structures deep in Henry's brain, first from one side and then from the other. Scoville had performed similar operations before, but only in patients with severe psychiatric disorders, mainly schizophrenia. Henry would be the first patient to undergo this procedure for intractable epilepsy. After 10 years of failed treatment, everyone agreed the operation would be Henry's best chance for relief. On August 25, 1953, William Scoville stood over the operating table and injected an anesthetic into his patient's scalp. Henry was awake, talking. He did not need general anesthesia because the brain does not have pain sensors and would therefore not register any pain during the surgery. When the anesthetic took effect, Scoville made an incision in Henry's forehead to reveal the bone. Just above Henry's eyebrows, he drilled two holes, 1.5 inches in diameter and 5 inches apart. The holes became doorways into Henry's brain through which the surgeon could insert his instruments. Viewing the brain from the side, we see how the bulge of the frontal lobes, which fills the space behind the forehead, curves down and meets a smaller bulge lower in the brain. Scoville aimed for the inner part of this lower bulge, the temporal lobes. Gaining access through one of the holes, Scoville inserted a long, thin brain spatula underneath one frontal lobe and lifted it up. He could now see the uncus, the front part of the hippocampus. The uncus, meaning hook, resembles a fist at the end of a bent wrist. To perform the resection, Scoville used a technique called aspiration, in which he guided a small instrument into the medial temporal lobe region. He then applied fine suction, and with that simple action, pieces of Henry's brain were sucked into the device. Scoville extracted the uncus, the front half of the hippocampus, and some neighboring cortex. He also removed most of the amygdala, which hugs the hippocampus and is critical for expressing and feeling emotions. Having finished his work on one side of Henry's brain, Scoville repeated the procedure on the other side. Because of Henry's case, we now know that damage to the hippocampus on both sides of the brain causes amnesia. But in 1953, scientists did not understand that the capacity for memory formation was localized to this particular area. This lack of evidence led to Henry's tragedy, and studies of his condition filled this gap in knowledge. Before the 1930s, anatomists believed that the main function of the hippocampus was to support the sense of smell. No one knew that a memory network occupied this structure. For Henry, the effect of removing the front half of the hippocampus was the same as if Scoville had sucked out the entire structure. The remaining 2 centimeters were deprived of input from the outside world and therefore non-functional. The major route by which information reaches the hippocampus is via pathways in the entorhinal cortex, which Scoville also removed. Thus, new information from vision, hearing, touch, and smell would not be able to reach the residual hippocampus. After the operation, Henry was taken to a recovery room, where doctors and nurses watched him closely to make sure that no life-threatening problems, such as hemorrhage, arose. They then took him back to his hospital room, where his parents were able to visit him. In the days that followed, Henry was drowsy, but otherwise seemed to make a good physical recovery. It soon became clear, however, that something was terribly wrong. Patients recovering from brain surgery often experience a period of confusion, but Henry's condition went far beyond that. He did not recognize the caregivers who came into his room every day, or recall the conversations he had with them. When Henry could not find his way to the bathroom, despite having been there several times before, his mother began to realize that something tragic had happened. Under questioning, Henry could recall some small events just before the time of his operation, but he did not seem to recall anything of his time in the hospital. By the time he left the hospital, 2.5 weeks after his operation, it was clear that Henry suffered from severe memory impairment, amnesia. The operation, however, did in fact accomplish what Scoville had hoped. Henry's seizures were dramatically curtailed, but this benefit came at a devastating cost. His parents, who always had had to take care of Henry because of his seizures, now found themselves with a son who could not remember what day it was, what he had eaten for breakfast, or what they had said just minutes before. For the rest of his life, Henry would be trapped in a permanent present tense.
At the same time, tomorrow, Deborah Weston continues to read Permanent Present Tense by Suzanne Corkin. The abridger was Richard Hamilton, and the producer was Elizabeth Allard. The shipping forecast is next here on Radio 4, and to take us there, it's sailing by. Thank you. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Tuesday, the 16th of July, 2013. The general synopsis at 1800. New low expected Iceland 997 by 1800 Tuesday. High Northwest Fitzroy 1027 and low Spain 1013, both slow moving with little change. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Sierra, south at Sierra. Westerly or southwesterly, 4 or 5. Occasional rain, moderate, occasionally poor. Northeast 40s, southwesterly 4, occasionally 5 later, mainly fair. Moderate or good, occasionally poor. Southwest 40s, Cromarty, 4th, Tyne.